Hello, and welcome to Breast Cancer Conversations, a podcast brought to you by survivingbreastcancer.org. I'm Laura Carfing, breast cancer survivor and founder of survivingbreastcancer.org, a nonprofit organization providing community, education, and resources to empower those diagnosed with breast cancer and their caregivers from day one and beyond. Hello, hello, my friends. It has been a couple of weeks since I dropped a new podcast episode, so this is really exciting. You may be wondering like what I've been up to the last couple of weeks. For those of you who don't know, in addition to like running all things SBC, survivingbreastcancer.org, William and I have been like in the deep throes of submitting like a whole bunch of grant applications to make sure that we have sustainable funding for our programs and services and for the podcast. In addition to all this great stuff, I also work a full-time job at Babson College. And so it was, you know, end of the semester plus commencement. And then I decided to be like a name reader at commencement. I don't know why. I was like, oh, I podcast. I speak. I could read names at commencement. I think I just like adding more stress to my life. I don't really know. But anyway, I took some time off from podcasting, maybe like 3 weeks or so. But I am so excited to be back into the throes of bringing amazing guests back onto the show, answering your questions, telling stories, providing inspiration. Oh my gosh, so much. So I'm really excited. Other things that I want to give a quick shout out to, just because we're launching this Monday, we are planning ahead. It's like, yeah, a novel idea sometimes, but we're planning ahead for Breast Cancer Awareness Month in October, and we are going to be hosting our fundraising event called Tell Cancer to Go Take a Hike. So no matter where in the world you are listening from, I am encouraging you to grab your friends, your neighbors, and your family, and your kids for an amazing day where we are going to take a hike. And if you're not into hiking, that's totally okay too. You could take a walk, you could take a stroll, do what feels good for your body. At the end of the day, we just want to bring the community together and get outside. This is a fundraiser, so I am going to link the URL in the show notes below. So you can sign up, you can start a team, you can join a team, and we can start fundraising between now and October. So I'm really excited about it. You'll be getting more information from our newsletter. If you haven't subscribed to our newsletter yet, please do so. survivingbreastcancer.org/subscribe. Well, let's dive into today's content. Clearly, I miss talking to you guys, and I could just go on and on and on about all the happenings in my world, but that is not why you are tuning in today. Today, we are speaking with Michelle Sandlin, and I am so excited because she is an award-winning writer and author of the best-selling book, Cancer Don't Care. In today's conversation, we talk about all things about early-stage breast cancer, her diagnosis, my diagnosis. She was also diagnosed with a genetic predisposition that her daughter also carries, so we talk about some of that burden, and then exercise, health, everything that, you know, happens when you have breast cancer. So I am so excited to have Michelle on the show today. I hope you enjoy today's topic. And without further ado, welcome to the conversation. Welcome, Michelle, to Breast Cancer Conversations. I am so excited to have you as one of our guests today, and we have a plethora of things to talk about that I know our listeners are going to be excited to hear. You know, just off the top of my head, you are a mother. You were diagnosed with early stage breast cancer, 2B specifically. You carry the BRCA1 gene. You shared earlier in your bio that you know, unfortunately, your daughter also carried the gene. So kind of talking about genetic mutations, understanding the importance of family history. You're also an award-winning author of an amazing book that came out, Cancer Don't Care. So we definitely want to talk about that. And you clearly have a lot of positivity and light and faith and love surrounding you that just emanates. So I am so excited to have you on the podcast today.
Well, I'm excited to be here. Thank you so much, Laura.
And where are you calling in from today?
I'm in Houston, Texas, where I've been for the last almost 39 years.
Okay. And, you know, I know it's always inspiring for other people to have moments of like hope and glimmer and knowing that there's life on the other side of receiving the news that you've been diagnosed with breast cancer.
Sure.
And, you know, I know when I was diagnosed at the age of 34, and I was just clamoring for someone to say, let's go get coffee. Let's go get a sandwich. Let me tell you, maybe not necessarily it's going to be okay because, you know, if you're living with metastatic disease, you're going to be on treatment for the rest of your life. But just knowing that you can navigate through life during such adversity and trauma. I would love for you to kind of share your story of how you found out you were diagnosed with breast cancer, and then what was kind of racing through your mind and how you ended up telling your family.
Yeah, so it really almost goes back to 2019. I was diagnosed in June of 2021, but I say it goes back to 2019 because on that year, I lost my mom, and I sort of started this crusade for myself to become the healthiest I could ever be. And she did not have cancer, so it was not related to her death. It was just that idea of your mortality, and just I needed an outlet to kind of separate me a little bit from the grief. And so first thing I did was buy a Peloton bike. And as soon as it arrived, I began what I would say is a 2-year journey of really becoming the healthiest, quote unquote, I had ever been. And then, you know, the pandemic hit and we were isolated, and working out and exercising and going for walks became an important thing for me to, you know, be able to clear my head and so forth. And so for 2 years, I had adopted this lifestyle where I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I didn't do recreational drugs. I worked out like a maniac 6 days a week for 1 to 2 hours a day. And I thought I was the healthiest I'd ever been. Much to my surprise, I was the most ill I had ever been. And so around May of 2021, I began to experience some intermittent pain in my right breast. And I kind of, you know, started attributing it to other things. Like I had recently had a COVID vaccine, and I'd read about how you can have lymph node swelling and soreness and all of this kind of thing. So I kind of was thinking about that. I even thought maybe I needed a more supportive sports bra. I mean, I started thinking about all kinds of different things.
Well, obviously, and your mind doesn't immediately go to like, oh, cancer.
No, maybe not at all. Not at all. And the pain was intermittent. So it was easy to, you know, forget about it, you know, here and there. And it was persistent, though, for, I'm embarrassed to say, about 4 weeks. And then what happened one night is I was in bed and I couldn't sleep because I felt like there was this almost needle prick poking at my right breast. And it got my attention. And so I sat up in bed and started feeling around. And right away, I felt a lump in my right breast, and it wasn't a big lump. I mean, it felt almost like, you know, a pebble or something right underneath the skin, but, you know, I kept feeling the left breast, the right breast, the left breast, the right breast, you know, trying to talk myself out of it. And then I would lay down and feel it laying down. Then I would, you know, sit back up and trying not to wake my husband in the bed because I didn't want to like freak me out, you know, at all. And so I somehow went to sleep that night, I don't know, and waited till the next morning and got out of bed, went over to the mirror, felt it again, looked at it. I could see it. It wasn't, you know, huge, but there was something visual there. And so I went downstairs, told my husband, you know, that pain I've been feeling. Well, I think there's a lump there, and he felt it. And as men often do, he said, I don't feel anything but a boob. So anyway, he couldn't feel it. I don't know if he didn't want to, or, you know, it's hard to know. I didn't want to know. I didn't want to feel it. But what I knew is I needed to call the doctor. I needed to go for an appointment right away. And so I got an appointment with my OBGYN. I had just had 4.5 months earlier an all clear mammogram. So this really, you know, was out of the blue. And he says, I feel what you feel. Let's get another mammogram. Let's get an ultrasound. And I said, okay. So I made an appointment for another mammogram and an ultrasound. And as the radiologist was, you know, reading the ultrasound, I was reading her face, and it wasn't good. And I said, you know, just tell me. And she said, well, I'm, you know, pretty certain it's positive for cancer. And you could have just like knocked me over with a feather. I mean, I couldn't believe the words that I was hearing. And so she asked me if I could come back later that day for a biopsy, which I did. And 4 days later, I was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer. And everything just went crazy fast after that.
Sure. Well, thank you for reliving that experience.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like it's just yesterday that all of this has happened and how
it's very fresh and raw.
Exactly. No matter how many years pass, right? I think we can all transport ourselves to that moment of, did I feel something? Do I notice something? Who do I tell?
Right.
I don't want to freak out the family, but then at the same time, you don't want to just keep it bubbling inside internally as well. So And it's not the first time either on the podcast that we're talking about like being in the best shape of our lives, being super healthy, and then finding out that we are diagnosed with cancer. It's, you know, I'm wondering, because this was also very similar with my story. I don't know if you know this about me either, but when I was diagnosed, I was also very active in working out, and I was a strict vegan at the time for a number of years leading up to it too. And so just the level, and I'm sure you might've felt this way too, like the level of frustration where you're like, I thought I was doing everything right. How could this happen to me? And then still have cancer, you know, from my perspective, and maybe just how I'm dealing with it and kind of appeasing myself is like, well, it's because I was healthy and in good shape. I was actually able to feel the lump. I was able to physically see the changes. Because, you know, if you're working out, you are paying attention to your physique. You are looking at your body image and noticing like, does one chest or pectoral muscle or breast look different than the other one, et cetera. And so just being hyper aware of those things, I think probably are, you know, for better or worse, a blessing in disguise.
Oh, I agree. And I think, and I've said this, you know, so many times that I was literally preparing for the fight of my life. And that's why I had, you know, conditioned my body and gotten in such good shape. And like I said, I thought I was the healthiest I'd ever been. I definitely wasn't that, but I can say for sure I was in the best shape I'd ever been.
Now, were you able to work out and maintain some level of activity throughout your treatment? Yeah, tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the first things we talked about when I knew I was going to be undergoing chemotherapy, because that was the treatment strategy. We were doing chemotherapy first and then surgery. And so one of my first questions out of the gate was, will I be able to work out? And they were like, absolutely. We encourage you to do that. Now, like I said, my workout routine had been 1 to 2 hours a day, 6 days a week. Obviously, that had a quick, you know, decline once chemo started. But I made it a practice that every single morning that I had chemo, I rode that bike before my chemo, because in my head and in my heart and everything I believed in was saying to me, if you're going to have poison entering your body today, you've got to do something healthy before that happens. And, you know, at first I was still doing, you know, like a 45-minute Peloton ride. By the last round of chemo, I think I was about 10 minutes on the Peloton, you know, before that morning. But, you know, I did other things too. I was still, you know, walking. I was still lifting weights. Did a little bit of yoga, you know, that type of thing. But I think it was one of the most important things that I did, not just to keep my body moving, but to keep me connected to what my lifestyle was prior to cancer.
It's a really good point to hold on to some level of normalcy during this like upheaval, for sure. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of dialogue right now about exercise and cancer in general. And, you know, it sounds counterintuitive, but, you know, when we exercise, we're actually combating all the fatigue that can come from the treatments that we're going through. And there were days where I just wanted to like sleep, and I didn't want to, like, it took more, I was going through treatment during the winter, and it took more time here in Boston to like get bundled up to go for a walk, to literally make it to like the end of the block. And I'd turn around to my husband and be like, you know what? That was good for today. Like, I'm good. Let's go back into the house, you know? And then there's other times I'm like ready to go and get my 10,000 steps and just like, you know, Energizer Bunny. So just listening to your body, I think, is so important. But doing, having that ritual, as you're describing, every day doing something is really great. I'm also noticing that there's some studies too coming out, and we're following this at survivingbreastcancer.org, is, you know, kind of finding what is that measurement of exercise? Is it 30 minutes? Is it 3 hours? How many minutes per week, et cetera, that actually helps someone who's living with a breast cancer diagnosis better tolerate the medicine and also reduce the chance of recurrence and progression. And so I think this is such an important topic, and I'm thrilled to hear that you've already like embraced all of this with your lifestyle, but this is now catching up with the science and the research as well. So I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Yes, that's important. And you know, being on the other side of it, I would say where I am today, I mean, I've ramped right back up to where I was in terms of my physical activity. And, you know, I don't look at it as something I have to do every day. I look at it as something I get to do every day. And that's so important to, you know, recognize the difference, because there were so many days, like you said, you know, where you're, you know, you have this crippling fatigue and you can't get out of bed when you're undergoing chemo and all of this stuff, that now being on the other side, I look at every workout as an absolute gift.
I need to embrace that, because it's not a gift for me yet. It's a chore. I like that idea of reframing it. It's something I get to do, something I have to do.
Right.
And on the topic of exercise too, you know, I know we get a lot of questions of, you know, going through surgery and, you know, maybe potentially losing mobility in our upper body, in our arms, et cetera. Tell me a little bit about your experience recovering from surgery and getting back into this workout routine. Obviously, everyone's experience is a little bit different. What worked for you?
I think it was important to listen to what my surgeons were telling me in terms of my healing and recovery and what the time frame would be. And when they said, you know, we don't want you lifting anything above, you know, 10 pounds, I mean, you have to listen to that. And so there were a lot of post-op appointments, and every single one, my question was, what can I do now? You know, how much can I lift? What can I do? And it was really using that as my, you know, guideline. But every time they told me I could do a little more, I was doing a little more. But you also, while you're listening to your healthcare providers, you're also listening to your own body, and your body will tell you what you're capable of doing and what's too much and so forth. And one of the limitations that I had following my double mastectomy and reconstruction surgery, because I had a deep flap where they remove you know, your abdominal tissue and create new breasts with that. And so it took me, I would say maybe close to a year before I felt like I could do things like plank or a push-up or crunches, because it just, I can't explain it. It just felt too tight and weird and different. And so I had to ease myself into that. So anything that was kind of lower abdominal, I was a little restricted, but that was my own body and probably my own head kind of preventing me from doing that. But apart from that, I you know, everything resumed.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And that's such an invasive surgery as well. And there's so many different choices people can make about that. And so figuring out, okay, how many surgeries do I want to endure? And then how do I get my physical body back to having that compassion, whether it's, you know, a week, 5 weeks, a year, et cetera. So I know for me, it's been yoga, and my poor husband has me lament about this all the time. He hears me lament about this all the time, because I used to be, again, working out pre-diagnosis, I would also do yoga like religiously. Like that was my mental health, my spiritual health, just emotional, like all the things. It's been so hard for me in like the last 5-6 years to get back into that routine, because I've lost so much upper body strength and because of the soreness or the tightness to not be able to do like the chaturanga or the push-ups. And that has become so triggering for me, where I'm like, okay, I don't want to do yoga and then just remember I had breast cancer. Like, that's not the point of this practice. And so I'm trying to find new activities, new things that I can get excited about. Have you found new activities that you're experiencing now after a diagnosis?
Well, I wouldn't say new since, you know, my diagnosis, but something that I incorporated in during the 2 years prior to the diagnosis was meditation. And I utilized that practice throughout my, you know, cancer journey. I'm very religious about it still in terms of the ability to, you know, center your thoughts, concentrate on your breathing, stop that freight train of anxiety that can just send us over the edge. And so there's a certain meditation that I listen to every night before I go to sleep, because the three words that you repeat in this meditation are safe, healed, and whole. And to me, that really is, that's everything. And it keeps saying, you are safe, you are healed, you're whole. And those are the words, man, those are the words that you want to hear when you're going through a health crisis. It's what you want to hear after a health crisis. And it's what you want to hear when your own head is going, is this going to come back? What's going on? You know, what do I need to be worried about today? So I think that meditation is has been one of the most beneficial practices that I've incorporated into my routine.
Oh, I love that. And I love the last word, whole, because mm-hmm. cancer can take so much away from us physically, emotionally, right, and mentally. And so to have that mantra of, I am still who I am whole, I am complete, I have right. what I need. So powerful.
Thank Absolutely. You for sure. For sure. Yeah.
I want to hear from all of my listeners who are going to go home tonight and like do this mantra with us. So
yes, yes, absolutely.
So another interesting fact that you were sharing about your diagnosis is that you also discovered that you tested positive for BRCA1.
Yes.
And you shared earlier, you know, I'm sorry about the loss of your mother, but that wasn't due to cancer. Mm-mm. So tell me a little bit about how you found out that you had this genetic predisposition.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I was clueless about that as well, because as far as I knew, we didn't have, you know, breast cancer in our family. So I thought my risk must be very, very low. My mother didn't have breast cancer or any cancer, neither did my grandmother's. So I felt like, you know, genetically speaking, I was pretty, you know, secure. But because I was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer, which is, you know, often associated with a BRCA1, you know, gene mutation, they did genetic testing early on and found out that I did have the BRCA1 gene mutation, which means that my risk of developing breast cancer during my lifetime was somewhere around 55 to 70%, you know, maybe even more. And so, and also my risk for developing other cancers, skin cancer, ovarian cancer. And so I also opted to have the preemptive removal of my ovaries and fallopian tubes. I had years before had my uterus removed, so there was no risk there. But that decision was an easy one too, because once you have a diagnosis, I'm like, let's get rid of everything possible. I don't want any problems in the future. So
taking control over the situation, mm-hmm. how you can.
Exactly. Exactly. And then when you test positive for the BRCA1 gene mutation, it becomes an obvious next step to have your immediate blood relatives tested as well. And my brother tested and my daughter had the genetics test as well. And they both tested positive for the BRCA1 gene mutation. Now for men, it's a little different and the risk is it's higher than, you know, the average for developing breast cancer and other cancers, but much lower than it is for women. And in my daughter's case, she ran the same risk I did. And so she just this past October opted to have a double mastectomy, reconstruction surgery. And then just last month, she had a full hysterectomy at age 33. So it was, a decision that we talked about a lot. And because she had seen, you know, me go through cancer and how horrible, you know, everything could be, she wasn't going to take that risk. And so she did what I am so proud of her for doing and what I think is the smart thing to do. And I know it's not something that, you know, a lot of women her age would agree to, but I'm so thankful that she did.
Yeah, absolutely. So you bring up a couple of great points too, just about being like having genetic testing done and how when you find out the answers, whether it's positive or negative, the results actually impact not just you individually, but your family members as well. And there is that level of burden, I would say, sitting on our shoulders of, okay, if I'm comfortable getting this test, I want to know the information. But do people in my family want to know the information? Because some people can have ostrich syndrome and just go right into the ground and be like, don't tell me, I don't want to know. And then there's other people who are really empowered with, give me as much information as you can give me so I can make informed choices.
Well, I mean, there were other immediate members of my family that were like, nope, pass. So, you know, they make their own decisions. You have to let that go.
Tell me about the conversations with your daughter when you found out that you tested positive for BRCA1, you know, as a mom talking to your child and then just knowing that there's a risk.
Well, you know, we found out that she tested positive while I was at the tail end of my chemo treatment. So this would have been, around, I don't know, maybe the last quarter of 2021. And so there wasn't a lot of conversation about what she should do or what the protocol would be, because it's kind of a long process to get in with an oncologist and get insurance to approve things. I mean, it's like navigating the healthcare system is a whole other conversation. And so the goal initially was really focused on me and getting me through what I needed to get through. And as soon as we got over that whole hump and I was cancer-free, yay, we focused, laser-focused on her health and what she needed to do. And so, like I said, it takes a while. We went through MD Anderson, but it still takes a while to get, you know, through all the red tape and be able to meet with, you know, breast oncology, ovarian oncology, I mean, all of this stuff.
Everybody.
Everybody. It's a whole barrage of, you know, we have to do MRIs. We have to do this. I mean, she had to have a baseline mammogram, you know, at age 32 instead of, you know, 40. So we started the process, but I think it became pretty obvious to her the more she was, you know, talking to the different healthcare providers, that this was recommended and that this could, you know, be cancer preventative and life, you know, the whole thing. It was extending everything, you know, you want to be able to do. And she's the mother of three boys. And at the end of the day, she wants to be here for those boys. And so I think the decision was an obvious one, but it took kind of going through the process of understanding everything that needed to happen. It's an educational process. And, you know, when I was diagnosed, I didn't even know what questions you should be asking. And it's like I had all of the questions and none of the questions at the same time. And I wish there was somebody who would say, hey, here's the questions you should be asking. Even your healthcare providers, they should say, you know, I know this is also overwhelming, but here are some things you should be thinking about. But there's like not a lot of time for that. And so having gone through everything first myself and then being able to tell her, you know, what they're telling you is because of this and this, I was more educated where I wasn't, had she been going through this without the knowledge that I had. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a long process. I would say it took probably a year to get from, you know, first conversations after genetic testing to, really get the ball rolling.
I think that's a really important point, talking about just the timeline. And, you know, I feel like with cancer or even not cancer, but going through preventative prophylactic surgeries, it's like hurry up and stop almost, right? You're like, okay, I need to do something because like there's cancer in me or I carry this gene and I need to take action. But then by exactly what you were saying, by the time you get appointments with the doctors and then the processing, right? Like you're absorbing all of that information and it's not like you want to make a decision right then and there. Come home, talk about it, think about it. If you're married with kids, like talk to your spouse and, you know, kind of digesting everything. And, you know, I know this is not exactly the same, but when I was going through prior to my surgery, because we weren't sure quite yet if I was a candidate for a lumpectomy or a mastectomy. But every day I was like, I really hope I can do a lumpectomy. Like, I hope we can shrink the tumor enough where I'm a candidate. Then the next day I'd wake up and I'm like, oh, double mastectomy. I never want to deal with this again. Then some days I'm like, I'm just going flat. I don't want to, like, you know, I was all over the board. But I needed that time to really, like, come to terms with what my decision was going to be. And once you arrive at that decision, then you're just like, I know I'm 100% good because I'm comfortable in the decisions that I'm making that affect my body and my health.
Right. Exactly. Well, you know, when I had the very first meeting with my breast surgeon and oncologist, you know, just days after my diagnosis, they were already using the term, you know, lumpectomy, mastectomy, or double mastectomy. And to be honest with you, I thought right away, I put it in my head, yeah, this is going to be a double. And as soon as I had the genetic test come back as BRCA1 positive, it was a done deal. It's like, yep, this is going to be a double mastectomy. So I think it helped that I'd kind of in my head already gone there. I think I'm a worst case scenario person, you know, kind of right out of the gate. But that's where my head was going, is that, yeah, this is going to be a double mastectomy.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I know we talked a little bit about exercise, your experience, your genetic predisposition, all of the things that you're going through. I want to change gears a little bit and talk about your professional life, which I find so beautiful because you are a writer at heart. And just a quick shout out to some of the programs and services we offer at survivingbreastcancer.org is that we have an expressive writing workshop every month that we do. And so whether you're a caregiver or recently diagnosed or having lived with the disease for a number of years, come for 90 minutes once a month to do expressive writing. And it is so powerful to put your thoughts and feelings to pen and paper. And I tell everyone, like, you don't have to be a writer. That's not the requirement. You're just showing up and using writing as a tool to release everything that we're holding on to. And I found that, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, meditation or just rituals or getting into like the habit of something. And so I'm curious to just dive into a conversation about your writing background and your book that you wrote and kind of chronicling your experience with breast cancer and the really unique ways in which you put together your book. So Michelle, I'd love to just like turn things over to you as like Michelle, the writer, the poet, the artist. Kind of hear a little bit more about your passion and how writing played a role throughout your breast cancer experience.
Well, thank you. I mean, I always think of myself as someone who's been a writer ever since I was, you know, big enough to hold a pencil in my hand. It's been my profession for, you know, the last over 20 years, but it's also been my lifestyle. And so it's my, you know, natural expression for myself to be able to write down my thoughts, my feelings, and so forth, whether it's through poetry or even, you know, journaling and whatnot. And so from the moment I was diagnosed, I made a decision that, you know, not only was I going to document my journey for me, but I was going to document it out loud because I wanted to be able to share what I was going through, lift the veil a little bit, show some behind the scenes, in front of the scenes. You know, this is me sitting in the chemo chair. This is me with my wig on. This is, you know, my husband, Kenny, who was, you know, I won't say front and center because he doesn't like to be front and center, but he was, you know, by my side, you know, standing next to the chemo chair and talking about, you know, the side effects and how I was feeling, and also to be able to stay connected to the people that, you know, were worried about me and wanted to know how I was doing. I mean, I'm a big proponent for, you know, having a community, your tribe of people that, you know, really beat the drum for you. And so, throughout my, you know, breast cancer treatment from diagnosis to well beyond, I was writing everything down. I was taking photographs. I was videoing. I was, you know, I had things written down on post-it notes and in my Apple notes and in my journal. I mean, it was everywhere. And I realized, you know, after I'd, you know, been through everything on the other side, I realized that, you know, I really had a book. And it was in, you know, bits and pieces all over the place. And my My writing style is very analog. I'm big into fountain pens and paper and inks and all the things, you know, that are connected with that. And so I started, you know, outlining everything and putting everything down. And I wrote my first draft of the book on 4x6 index cards by hand before even putting it into the computer. And my reason for doing that is, and this is not unique to me, you can find this online everywhere, but when you stop to really write things down as opposed to clicking around on a keyboard, you're more connected to the words. It slows down your thoughts, and it allowed me to think about the words, think about the rhythm of the sentences, and really express myself in a way that I felt was really close to the bone, close to my heart, close to everything that I was feeling. And so I spent, I would say, the better part of a year writing the book. It didn't take me that much time to write the first draft. It was the refining of everything. Once it got to the computer, you know, then the real, you know, editing begins. But by writing it by hand, I didn't do a lot of self-editing. I let it come out kind of as it happened and, you know, so forth. And so I wrote it in almost like a vignette style with, you know, different sections pertaining to different aspects of what I was going through, you know, in the moment. But my whole goal really in writing the book was several things. I mean, it was obviously a very cathartic, you know, experience. But it allowed me to process, I mean, like really, truly process what had happened. Because when I was first diagnosed, things started moving really, really fast. I mean, we went from diagnosis to MRIs to, you know, getting your port put in to first chemo to hair falling out. I mean, it was so, so fast. And because my tumor, they said, was so aggressive, the treatment had to be equally aggressive. And so there's not any time to stop and think or process. And when I first announced my diagnosis to my friends and family, I did so, not my immediate family, but the larger group of people out there, I did it on social media because I felt like I could reach the most people that way. And so I did a video. And, you know, it sort of started off with me saying that, you know, I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I didn't do drugs. I was an ideal weight. I work out like a maniac, but guess what? Cancer don't care. And that was the first time it just sort of came out. I said the words cancer don't care. And it became obvious to me that that's really the book, that it doesn't matter who you are. I mean, you can be the King of England and get cancer, right? So it was this whole idea that it didn't matter, you know, who you are, what your background is, you know, what your family's like, what your responsibilities are, what your workout routine is, none of that. And so I kind of had to quickly in my mind, you know, internalize that I have cancer, I've got to move forward, and this is what we're going to do. And so I really tried to, you know, impart that in my book in a way that I hope and pray really inspires people, whether they are going through a breast cancer diagnosis of their own or on their journey, or whether they're supporting someone who, you know, has cancer, but even people that don't even, you know, have cancer touch their lives. I think there's a lot of life lessons, a lot of, you know, my own philosophical musings. And like I said, I go back to inspiration a lot. It's my favorite word because I don't think there's anything more powerful than being able to inspire someone to do something important in their life, whether it's, you know, working out, eating healthy, you know, whatever it is. And so I hope that people, you know, read my book with the idea of, or with the takeaways that, you know, this was something really horrible that, you know, someone went through, but that I did it with a positive attitude. I really leaned into my faith, my love, my community, and all the things that were important to have in my orbit. But at the same time, and I talk about this a lot, to get rid of the things that no longer served me. And sometimes that means that you have to clean house and get rid of a few people that no longer bring joy to your life. Let's put it that way. And I didn't want anything around me that was negative, that would bring down anything. And I really set the tone when I was diagnosed. I mean, from day one, I said, no tears. No one's going to cry. There's nothing. We're not crying. This is not the time for tears. If there is down the line, God forbid, then we'll cry, but it's not happening now. And so I really maintained that throughout. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that people will find in the book is that in spite of everything, there was that positivity because I could always see the light at the end of the tunnel, as my mom always said. I could always see that there was something more. I never thought really that this was going to be the end for me. Now, that's not to say that you're not face to face with your own mortality, because you absolutely are, and you realize how serious the moment is. But at the same time, I just knew in my heart that this wasn't that moment. And I just did everything in my power to fight through everything. And I really tell that story, throughout the book, and I weave in, you know, a lot of messages that I think are healthy ones. And the feedback that I've had from people who are currently in the trenches is, you know, that they're benefiting from, you know, hearing my take on these things. So, and it's a way to pay it forward, I think. There were so many people that came out for me and just really showed up in spectacular ways. But there's also people who spectacularly were absent. And when you go through a health crisis like this, I think it tells you who your people are, you know, and those are the ones that rally around you. And those are the ones you're always going to rally around as well.
Well said. Well said. So the name of your book, Cancer Don't Care, where can people find it?
It is on Amazon. So it's in hardback, paperback, and Kindle edition.
Congratulations. I mean, thank you for sharing your story, your passion, your work, and paying it forward. I know your book is going to help so many people. Just know that they're not alone going through all of this. And so I really appreciate you sharing here today on the podcast, but then also in written form where people can go back and know that they could find inspiration in the written words and have hope there too. So thank you. And thank you everyone for listening to our show. I would like to acknowledge that all of the information on our podcast are from personal experiences and are not a substitute for professional medical advice. You should always contact your medical care team. If you're looking for specific topics or would like to be a guest on our show, please feel free to reach out to me. My email is laura@survivingbreastcancer.org. Until next time, keep on thriving.